Welcome to School of Movies.
Brother Bear.
The world is full of magic. Winter turns to spring. Small things become big. One thing always changes into another.
Walt Disney Pictures presents an all-new motion picture event.
Are we there yet?
Don't make me turn this formation around!
You have no idea where they are!
You just talked!
Just back away, real slow-like.
What's going on?
How's it going, Bear?
I'm not a bear.
Well, gee, you're one big beaver.
No kidding.
I'm a man. I was transformed into a bear, magically.
But crazy.
Gesundheit. Do either of you know where the lights touch the earth?
No.
Hey, I know that place.
You do?
Yeah, follow me.
My name's Coda. Say it with me. Coda.
I don't want to brag or nothing, but I'm a raging ball of brown fur.
Oh, really?
This November.
And keep all that cuddly bear stuff to a minimum, okay, kid?
The truth is, I got separated from my mom.
See through another's eyes.
Those monsters are really scary, especially with those sticks.
Feel through another's heart.
Coda, don't be afraid.
And discover the meaning of brotherhood.
I always wanted a brother.
Coda!
Featuring songs by Academy Award winner Phil Collins. Walt Disney Pictures presents Brother Bear.
We're back with Daniel Floyd to continue the Disney animated history shows. Hello, Daniel.
Hello.
And hello, Sharon.
Hello.
Now, this one was brand new to Dan, as in fact was the next one as well. So we're going to be hearing his thoughts fresh as a daisy on both of them. Brother Bear was released in November 2003. The original premise was going to be a North American set thematic follow-up to The Lion King, which, of course, we all know was Hamlet with lions. Of course, the bear is the king of the forest. So this was going to be, and I swear I'm not making this up, King Lear with bears. Let's let you percolate on that one. That changed to a king whose son is turned into a bear and stays a bear at the end. This was proclaimed by then president of Disney Feature Animation, Thomas Schumacher, remember that name, to be the idea of the century. And bear in mind, he was talking in the middle of the tail end of the 20th century at that point. Then around 2000, it became a story of a young man turned into a bear who is guided on his journey by a real bear named Grizz, played by Michael Clarke Duncan. And having seen this film, I really would like to see how that would have turned out. Because
I do too.
It would have been a different type of movie. And, I'm going to say later on, Michael Clarke Duncan was 98% bear anyway. They just made him look like a bear. So it would have been a wonderful role for him to play as an actual full lead character as opposed to a small support role. Eventually, it became a Canadian story about three Inuit brothers. Sitka, the eldest, attempts to guide his hot-headed siblings but is killed accidentally fighting off a bear. Kenai, the youngest, seeks revenge on the beast itself, and angering the spirits, he's transformed into a bear. The middle brother, Denahi, hunts this new bear, who he doesn't realize is his own brother, for his own revenge, and Kenai seeks the spirit so he can change back, helped along by an exuberant young bear named Coda, who turns out to be the cub of the one killed in angry revenge. Kenai's journey is all about learning to stop being so very self-absorbed and to nurture Coda, who, despite being annoying, takes a shine to him immediately and begins to depend and ultimately love his new brother. The finale sees Kenai return to human form after sacrificing himself to save the cub and then willingly change back into a bear in order to continue to care for him. Oh, and they keep meeting these two really annoying moose. Mooses? Meese? Who won't shut the hell up. Ay, ay, ay. So, Side note, normally I edit out all the times we go, and ah. But in this one, it feels appropriate. What did you make of this one, Dan?
I have a very hard time mustering strong feelings about Brother Bear in general.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is clearly aiming for that Lion King success and the bombast and the scale.
Mm-hmm.
But
in the same way that Tarzan was, yeah.
Much in the same way, but unlike Tarzan even, the execution just isn't there, I don't think. I think a lot of the attempts fall flat, and I think a lot of the big flaws are ultimately on the script level, because there are a lot of individual parts of this film that work really well.
Mm-hmm.
I should talk positive before I get all
about it.
I very much like the background art, because those landscape paintings are beautiful, and I really like the idea to have the North American forest and wilderness become more bright and vibrant after Kenai's transformation. I think that's a really cool idea.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people wouldn't even notice it because it's so vibrant up until then.
Yeah, yeah. It does result in a slightly weird... There's a very sharp tonal shift the instant he turns into a bear, which kind of takes it from a Pocahontas-feeling Disney film to a Lion King-feeling Disney film. Not a huge deal, but it does... There is a very... It's kind of sharp. It doesn't transition you very, very evenly.
Which does also give the feeling that there are two completely different movies mashed together in this.
Yeah, it starts out feeling very Pocahontas-like because it's, again, set in a real North American historical period with the native people and an attempt at really capturing what the culture looked like and attempt to capture the spiritual side of that culture as well, and to realize it as a real thing that actually existed in a magical sense.
Yeah, they're clearly trying to be very respectful to the Inuit as well. They're not just messing around, and it's a very far cry from Peter Pan.
Oh, for sure. But then the instant he becomes a bear, then it shifts much more into Lion King mode and gets way more gag heavy, and it just feels like a very different film. And eventually, I think those two tones even out. Mm. But I also actually really like Joaquin Phoenix as Kenai. I don't think the script does him any favors, mm-hmm. but he's got a really good voice and he really throws himself into it. I think he did quite well. And you're absolutely right that Michael Clark Duncan's Tug character, the little support bear role that he does fill.
It's a cameo, really.
Yeah. It's a cameo, basically, but he's one of the best things in this movie still.
Absolutely.
He's only in it for a few minutes, but he's totally got that Phil Harris Baloo warmth.
Oh, no, don't say that.
No, he totally does.
I want this version even more.
I do too. Like, I don't know if it would have been better. Who can tell? Their movies go through so many versions on their way to the final
product.
Remake
it with Kevin Michael Richardson. Do it. Do it now.
I would watch it. I'd totally watch that. I also really like the sequence... I guess it's kind of jumping ahead story-wise. I like the sequence with Kenai's realization moment when Coda is telling his story to the other bears, because it's really effective, it's edited really well, and it's one of the few times I think the film really succeeds in fully capturing the emotion of the moment.
Yeah.
Because it's not even like a shocking reveal. I think most everyone's guessed this story point by the time the twist is revealed, but... Even knowing it, the scene makes you feel what Kenai is feeling in those flashes of memory. And those memories are triggering with extra details triggered by Coda's story. And the flashbacks come with slightly different angles and little details added in a brief moment where the bear, even though it still looks really bear-like and non-humanized, like says Coda's name or says something, has a motherly line in it. Little subtle stuff like that that makes... Yeah. Even if you're seeing the same camera angle, it makes it feel really differently. It's really effective and well, good filmmaking.
Actually, speaking of that, I can't believe we got this far without mentioning that basically watching Brave, which I had no idea would have as much bear in it as it actually ended up having. I was kind of like, does anyone else see that this is basically Brother Bear, but it's Mother Bear? It was almost like this film didn't do well at the box office at all, so let's have another go at it. but they do the same thing in this that when a bear is portrayed through human eyes, it's got these little black beady eyes, and it's obviously got an animal's mind in there, and there isn't that connection between the two. But as soon as a bear is looking at another bear through comprehending human in a bear eyes or bear in a bear eyes, if that makes any sense. Like, if you're on the bear's level, then suddenly those eyes are big with the dots in the middle as normal. They use that in Brave to show, you know, the switcheroo between the mother having complete control of herself and suddenly not getting it. But, I mean, like, you saw Brave first, so this must have felt more like a retread.
In a way, like, it does have a lot of the same... I mean, obviously, a lot of very similar surface elements. You've got characters who turn into bears. You've got a lot of...
Until they learn an important lesson.
Right, a lot of emphasis on family and empathy and growing up, mm-hmm. and characters being able to communicate with each other and understand each other better. A lot of those key themes and elements are there, but maybe it's just because of the presentation of this where it feels... This film ultimately feels to me like it is a... desperate, pale attempt at capturing, at imitating Renaissance Disney glory. It is trying very hard. I mean, from the very beginning when Eisner first conceived it, like, let's make Lion King again, but let's make it with bears. And instead of taking inspiration from Hamlet, let's take it from King Lear. Like, it's conceptually quite derivative of Disney's own past work and past glory.
Yeah.
Again, the execution not being there, it just doesn't land in quite the same place.
It's like trying to recreate the Super Soldier Serum. It's, you know, you're going to get a lot of screwed up Hulks.
That was put on ice for a reason.
It is sad for me watching these two in particular because normally I think watching this, I would just feel kind of just ambivalent about it and not care one way or another, because it's just because there have been plenty of Disney films before this that were pretty mediocre, didn't really register on an emotional level. They're cute and they have some good moments, but they just don't really grab you. But knowing that at this point, I'd like to think that Brother Bear, if it had been the Lion King success that they'd hoped it was, might have saved Disney Animation's traditional studio from being shuttered. But honestly,
it would have also had to follow up a very successful Treasure Planet and Atlantis as well, though.
Yeah, it probably would have. That's the thing. By this point in production, by the time this came out, the studio was already being shut down. Like, I mean, you're right. After Atlantis and Emperor's New Groove and Treasure Planet bombing, and with Pixar, DreamWorks, and now Blue Sky blowing up in popularity. I mean, like, the year before this was released, the Paris and Tokyo animation studios had already been shut down. The majority of the Burbank staff had been laid off, leaving just enough people to finish up Home on the Range, but there were no new features in the works after that or planned, and the new computer animation team was already being put together. It was... the fight to save traditional animation was already lost, and the company was just running out the clock by this point.
It's like an office, like, which has been bought by another company and is being dismantled, like, just the last few weeks of work when everyone's just, like, kind of checked out. But not entirely. Like, imagine if they're also having parties.
Oh, yeah. And it doesn't mean that the people who were still there weren't putting their all into the work, because I still think there is some great work in both of these two last films before the big shift.
Including Home on the Range. Wow. Okay.
We'll get to it later. I like Home on the Range better than Brother Bear.
We'll get to that in a bit. But
we will get to it later.
We're in another Rescuers Down Under situation.
that'll be fun. But knowing that kind of outside industry information definitely impacts my feeling watching these last two movies. And yeah, it ultimately makes them a bit more melancholy and sad for me, just knowing what must have been going on and seeing and knowing what the artists making all this work must have been going through at the same time. And
yeah,
it's that we're at the pretty much the low point of Disney history right here.
Yeah, we've passed this point with the Home on the Range. I suppose, you know, whether you like Home on the Range or not, once you hit Chicken Little, we're in what's the opposite of flavor country? Flavorless, tasteless country. So
yeah,
yeah. There's got to be people out there who really like Chicken Little, and I don't mean to upset them, but
maybe I'm one of those people. I don't know. I haven't watched it.
You never saw? Oh, it does not feel like Disney. I'll tell you that right now.
I believe there's, in a certain way, even the things that are being made now don't quite feel like Disney, even though they are still great.
Yeah.
So. But it's a different era and with its own strengths and great things. But yeah, that is what is the tragedy of this. Even though these last two films weren't even the last two traditionally animated Disney films, they do feel like this is the end of an era that had a brief encore.
To its credit, actually, now that you mention it, Brother Bear does definitely feel like Disney. If you're a big fan of the 90s Renaissance but for some reason didn't see this one, get hold of it. It's inexpensive on DVD, so it's worth watching. It's a mixed bag. The highs for me are actually really high. The musical moments, not Phil Collins, but all a lot of the other musical moments, really, like when the sort of the drums start in and you get sort of the choral elements in there, and like something big and spiritual is happening. It like your heart soars at that point.
I agree. Those are really nice handles. Bits of score. Yeah.
Yeah. And if it could have sort of kept that and been funny the whole way through somehow, it might have been closer to The Lion King, ultimately, because that same kind of feel to it. Let's go back to the beginning, because there are a couple of things we noticed along the way, and we're going to do them in chronological order. Just so that we can sort of remember bits that were happening. The first line in it, it's what turns out to be the middle brother, Denahi, as an old man talking to a bunch of Inuit children. And he says, Sharon, what was the line? Long ago, when the mammoth roamed these lands.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, do you want to go for it?
Well, right, my issue with that, and to start with, I mean, I really like this opening.
Yeah.
Generally, the whole thing feels perfect. And I think, in all honesty, the opening is the route they should have gone with this film.
Yeah.
It feels like a small, mythological, almost like a Bible story type approach.
It's Ice Age, but done with more gravitas.
Yeah.
A lot more gravitas.
Yeah, but I mean, I can certainly see where the whole Lion King comparison comes from. It feels a little bit like Pocahontas as well. They're obviously going for that sort of that big spiritual feel, but in a small personal story, which if they'd stuck with that and not dissolved into the madcap moose antics, then I probably would have liked it a whole lot better. In fact, if I could probably just scissor out the middle and appreciate this film much better. But yeah, the line about long ago when mammoth roamed the earth, he's talking about not even his own like tiny childhood, his own adolescence. So we're talking about what, maximum 30, 40 years here?
Considering how old people actually lived, they died of old age and fear at the age of 30.
Well, animals don't go extinct overnight. It
That's
takes
a
while.
The mammoth is gone now. Yeah, because of you.
Unless there were like three left when he was 15 and then they'd all disappeared by the time he grew up.
And my brother rode on one.
But he says they were roaming the earth. So one must assume that there's at least a handful of them still left now.
This is just us being persnickety about the wording of it. But basically it's supposed to draw you in and go, long ago when the mammoth roamed the earth.
I guess that line's talking to us, the viewer, modern day, technically, even though it doesn't quite fit.
Yeah.
You crazy old Uncle Denahi. I saw a mammoth
this
morning.
There's three out there right now.
And so, yeah, there's that bit. That draws you in, and you get these lovely kind of like it shows the three brothers, you know, they're kayaking downstream, and there's like loads of sort of ice shifting, and it feels like, it says, you know, where it's got Tina Turner singing, and she's like, back in time when the earth was young. And it's like, again, earth was young. This is really only not that long ago in terms of actual earth history. But I suppose what you mean is before we ravage the hell out of it. One of my favourite ways of getting perspective on the age of the Earth is Bill Bryson in The Short History of Nearly Everything. The term Precambrian is in reference to an extreme amount of time before there was complex life on Earth. And the following statement is intended to give you perspective on how short a time human beings have actually been walking the planet. Perhaps an even more effective way of grasping our extreme recentness as a part of this 4.5 billion year old picture is to stretch your arms to their fullest extent and imagine that width as the entire history of the Earth. On this scale, according to John McPhee in Basin and Range, the distance from the fingertips of one hand to the wrist of the other is Precambrian, 88% of the Earth's existence. All of complex life is in one hand, and in a single stroke, with a medium-grained nail file, you could eradicate human history. Oh, and being afraid, hating each other, appointing the dumbest people as our leaders, dividing, refusing to unify, fixating only on the differences between us, refusing to teach or accept science, refusing to give science far, far greater weight than superstition, facts being outweighed by misinformed feelings, refusing to focus on the best aspects of our religion and instead focus on the parts that divide and conquer, refusing to look after each other, denying climate change, and generally acting like we ourselves are the most important thing in existence, but on an individual scale rather than a global scale. That's that nail file. Apologies for the existential crisis you probably didn't expect from a Brother Bear episode.
We are all.
still get the meaning on that. And she's got a great kind of soaring sing-song here. And because you're also seeing Tanana, the female shaman, thumbs up there, by the way, there's kind of a feeling like that she's being identified with Tina Turner there as well, which is great. And you get sort of this Inuit folklore side of things, and they're sort of, originally they were going to be just sort of dancing on this outcrop of rock, and then they turned it into a sort of an open air cave type thing, possibly because someone mentioned, well, that's just Pride Rock. Otherwise, it doesn't have the same kind of deep canvas feel as Tarzan, but it's got a similar flavor. If you get my drift, it actually, animation wise, it feels closest to Mulan at this stage.
Which makes sense, because this was still the Orlando studio and their third and final film, and Mulan was the one that preceded it. No, wait, Lilo and Stitch was the one that preceded it. Mulan was before that.
So it's less rounded than Lilo and Stitch, but it's...
That might be what emphasizes the mythical feel, though, because it's Mulan had that
yeah,
sort
it's
of...
Yeah, folklore again.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I applaud them for basically trying something new rather than just going for... The worst thing animation can do is to go for what's trendy and streetwise and what everyone else is doing. Because for a start, you're going to be a year or two late. And secondly, it's going to date like crazy.
Yeah. It's true. These take too long to make.
And there was a lot of that going on in the early 21st century. A lot. It went from like Disney having the complete monopoly to a load of new studios springing up and all basically competing with each other for the next screaming animal picture. The transformation is another fantastic moment, and the moment where Kenai kills the bear, it feels wrong, and it feels like everything leading up to it is like every step of the way you could have not done this, and you could have turned back. But he's portrayed as a hot-headed young man who, whilst not ugly in how angry and hate-filled he is for this bear, is not able to actually consider the broader situation. Mm. And he is also ultimately grieving for his brother, so it's understandable.
I think they do get the raw emotion in all the brothers across quite well in this section, though, because the moment where Kenai kills the bear, it's almost, although he's gone after her in anger and fury, and you know, obviously this incredibly strong love that he has for his brother is been converted into this grief and rage. When the moment happens, it's pure self-defense. She leaps for him and he just holds the spear up in fear. And I think the transitions and the way they make the camera movements so quick, and it's all very confusing. And it's the idea that in that situation where you've got all these major emotions washing around, things become unclear. It's not entirely cut and dried what's happened and who it's happened to and who's to blame and what started it. Everything kind of just mashes in together, and I think they really do get that across quite well. And the obviously the weather changing and the ground shifting and all that kind of thing. There's just this feeling of everything being uncertain and everything constantly moving, and all of them having to fight really, really hard to keep a grip on who they are and how they feel.
And his redemption when it finally comes is kind of a reversal of that scene where he's in the form of the bear. It's a similarly panicked and chaotic moment, but his instinct there is rather than to protect himself, to protect someone else. So that sort of comes full circle.
And if you look at the fact that technically speaking, when he kills the bear, she's defending Coda, and so is he.
Yeah.
So it really is a completely fair swap.
It puts her in her. It puts him in her paws.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's important to note that wonderful choral element that feels so tribal, so natural, so ancient, and so connected with the Inuit and the Native American people is in fact a Bulgarian women's choir. You almost couldn't get much further apart than Bulgaria and Canada. But it's supremely effective, so much so that James Horner used similar voices in his Avatar soundtrack to kind of immerse us in a tribal background. And Disney used similar voices in their Rivers of Light show at Animal Kingdom, which is spectacular, I might add. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that happens. And then the moose turn up and stay.
I will say, I've lived in Canada for 3.5 years. And
These are the most Canadian people you've ever seen.
No, that's the thing. Like, I heard the word A in this film more than I did in my entire time up in Canada.
I thought this was unnatural levels of A.
It is. It is. It is a American's stereotype perspective of what a Canadian talks like. And
is
I feel like at least
South
one of these
Park?
Actors, in a way, yes.
Look, guy, we have to stay strong. If you don't stand with your fellow Canadians, then you are a rat.
Don't call me a rat, buddy.
I'm not your buddy, friend. He's not your friend, guy. I'm not your guy, buddy.
He's not your buddy, friend.
I'm not your friend, guy.
Let's give it up, guy.
Don't call me your guy. I am not your guy, friend.
I'm not your friend, buddy.
I'm not your buddy, guy.
Because the South Park one is at least funny, and it's pushing the stereotypy version like in the right way and in the right places. I think there's a lot of times when these guys just say A at the end of a sentence that doesn't feel right as like the right place to put it. And I feel like Rick Moranis is Canadian, isn't he?
Yeah.
I poor guy.
I think this was his last film as well. He pretty
That's
much
sad.
Like, he hung up his towel and went, right, I've got enough money now. I can, you know, from the Honey, I Shrunk the Kids movies, I can probably stop now. And Rick Moranis, one of the funniest guys in the 80s.
It's true.
How is he not funny here?
A beaver.
I'm not a beaver. I'm a bear. No, I mean, I'm not a bear. I'm a man.
Excuse me?
I was transformed into a bear, magically. I was lifted into the sky by my brother. Crazy!
Gesundheit.
No. Fruitcake!
Are you okay?
No! That bear! Over there! He's crazy!
I am not crazy!
Who ever said you were? We understand.
You do?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You see, we're not moose either.
We're not?
No! We're like, we're like squirrels, yeah.
Oh. Oh, yeah! Beauty, eh? He's actually the squirrel, eh? I'm more of a purebred Wolverine. Look at these cuspids.
Give him a little room.
Why am I even talking to a couple of dumb moose?
No, we're squirrels, eh?
Wolverine.
The comedy all falls flat, despite him being a very funny person. Mm. It is really script-level stuff that I think is what hurts this film the most. Like, most of the comedy falls flat. Like it has some funny moments, but most of it doesn't quite land. And the sense of character drama in the dialogue and the way that it ties to the themes feels inconsistent in various places and a little hard and just unclear in others. I think we've talked a couple times about how the beginning of the film feels like a different movie than the later part after he becomes a bear. And I think part of that is the tone, for sure, because they definitely feel different, and the film looks different. But I think it is also because this film introduces a lot of different, very valid, great themes and motivations and ideas for its character. That it's got the sense of empathy for a group that you don't understand. It's got this coming of age growing up that Kenai needs to go through. It's got... what are some of the other really good themes it's got going?
I'll let you go on this one.
Thank you.
It's got the blending of the worlds of man, animal, and spirit.
Yes.
Which is reflected in the fact that at the very end, you have one brother who's spirit, one brother who is an animal, and one brother who's a man.
Absolutely. And I think they're all good themes, and they're all touched on at various points of the film, but I have a hard time deciding for sure which one of them defines this movie beginning to end, which one of them defines Kenai's arc beginning to end. And if one of them does, I think there are a lot of places in the film where the
other takes over,
where something else takes over, or where the dramatic momentum of that arc and that theme falls to the wayside or is ignored by the character entirely for a large chunk. And I think the middle third is really where a lot of things start to drag
or get upstaged by a moose.
Or get upstaged by moose, or just be a sense where there's a real lack of dramatic momentum. Like that there's Kenai knows he's got an objective, like he knows he doesn't want to be a bear anymore, and he knows he has to get to this place, I guess, which will, like, where the light touches the earth, where something will happen. For most of that middle third, he doesn't seem too eager or anxious to get there. His motivation mostly seems to be to be annoyed at the smaller bear for a long time. And the smaller bear's motivation doesn't, it's really hard to see why he's hanging around Kenai. His motivation seems to just be kind of annoy Kenai. So you just have two characters who are annoying one another or being annoyed by the other and traveling together for some reason for a long time, and while bad comedy happens. Yeah. And it just kind of drags for a good chunk before it picks back up again.
Now that you mention it, Coda's arc would have really benefited from at one point after Kenai starts telling him about his mother being dead, for Coda to say, "I know." And for him basically to admit that he has known that his mother's been dead for quite some time now, and he's just been trying not to confront it. Because that would have been an arc for him to basically come around to that.
It does feel like it needs one more moment of Coda dropping the kind of fun, cute...
little stinker.
Little kid thing. And that he does. In the movie, he does have that moment, but... Phil Collins keeps singing over it.
Oh, yeah. I've got here Collins creep. Do you know what that is? It's like feature creep, only it's when Phil Collins sidles in the middle of a moment, like an emotional moment, maybe in this case, like a really good emotional moment, and starts singing, "Oh, brother bear, I was so blind." And it's like, oh, shut up, Phil. Just let it play out. And they're actually, they're lowering the volume on this quiet, dignified conversation between these two characters we've come to care about to let Phil Collins bleat away.
Everywhere I turn, I hurt someone. But there's nothing I can say to change the things I've done. Of all the things I hid from you, I cannot hide the shame. And I pray someone, something will come to take away the pain. There's no way out of this dark place. No hope, no future.
I did actually shout it at the screen while watching it. Shut the hell up, Phil Collins. I'm trying to hear the bears.
Yeah. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you for validating me on this one. Because even like like when Coda starts singing, "Tell everybody I'm on my way." And then Phil's like, "I'll take this one. Tell everybody." Like, shut up, Phil. The kid's going to sing.
Tell everybody I'm on my way. New friends and new places to see. With blue skies ahead, yes, I'm on my way, and there's nowhere else that I'd rather be. Tell everybody I'm on my way, and I'm loving every step I take. With the sun beating down, yes, I'm on my way, and I can't keep this smile off my face. 'Cause there's
It's really quite a well-balanced, annoying character in terms of Coda, because he is annoying, but he's lovable, kind of in a donkey kind of way. He's not funny in the way that Donkey is, but you want good things to happen to him. He's not just an annoying little piss weasel.
Yeah, I don't hate Coda, actually. Like, I think he's... I mean, these characters are definitely a tough balancing act of cute and annoyance, and the cute has to always just slightly edge out over the annoyance for you to not hate the kid.
Mm-hmm.
And there are times where I think maybe he's either just slightly too annoying or not quite cute enough to get away with it. But it, for the
word
part,
is precocious. My yes. God, is he precocious?
He's totally precocious. But you don't end up hating the character, which is the important thing.
Yeah.
I think the balance is mostly maintained. Speaking of Phil Collins stuff, like, I actually don't have strong negative feelings for the songs in this either. I think melodically I'm fine with them, and I know he helped write the score too. And
the Tina Turner song is also his. He just sort of stepped back and let her play sing it because she's better at it for that particular moment.
Yeah, and I think he might actually sing less in this than in Tarzan.
Oh yeah, he does. Yeah, he wants to be all the characters though. You know, like in Tarzan, yeah. he was Carla for the scum. Stop your crying, it'll be all right. And then he was the narration voice for Two Worlds.
And then the same for Son of Man. And then he's Rosie O'Donnell for Trash in the Camp. And then he's Tarzan for Strangers Like Me.
He veers back and forth between, like, he's the voice of the movie, which is too much to give to one man.
And I don't think he's a great fit for being the voice of either of these two films. Yeah. I think,
although we were told by plenty of listeners after the Tarzan episode that Phil Collins is A-OK with you guys.
You can totally have a singer and their voice be the voice of the film singing a lot of these songs. And I can't think of a good example right now, but
somebody, somebody big and black with a great voice. Tina Turner, frankly, would have been great.
Tina Turner or the
stuff. Just crooning away for the quieter stuff.
There was a group of singers who did the family.
Boys to Men?
No, it wasn't Boys to Men. It was a
Welcome to Our Family.
No, there was another. What are they called?
We Are Family. Sister Sledge.
Is it? It may be. There is a group of singers of like really great four black men who are singers. There's like two younger ones and two really old guys. Blind Boys of Alabama. That's it.
Oh, okay.
The Blind Boys of Alabama sing, I think it's the family song, or they participate in the family song, and they could have been perhaps a great voice for this film. I think the reason Phil Collins' songs bother me more in this one than in Tarzan, but to an extent in Tarzan as well, is that...
Quite aside from the fact that he's whiter than the first lifeboat off the Titanic, providing the voice for a story where there isn't a single white man in sight. So, you know, maybe an Inuit recording artist?
The lyrics to the songs he writes are aggressively bland and generic. That's what they lack. There's like they don't have any of the Howard Ashman empathy or cleverness. They don't have any of the Tim Rice wit. They almost sound sarcastic or like self-parody at times. Like he's just like someone is improvising, here, sing along to this and make it sound like a bad Disney song. Welcome to Our Family. And I don't think he's phoning it in. I think he's actually I think he was doing it his best, but I wonder if he felt that writing songs for a Disney family film inherently meant talking down to an extent.
Yeah.
Like if he felt like he needed to make that I'm writing for a Disney film, that means this is simple and basic and for the kids and for, yeah, just nothing too complex that'll go over anyone's head.
One jump ahead of the slow pokes, one skip ahead of my doom. Next time, gonna use a nom de plume.
Nom de plume, a pen name, meaning a secret identity. In the early 90s, Disney did not talk down to the kids with their songs.
I don't know. Like, I don't want to blame him because he's not untalented. He has written some great songs.
Phil Collins, not untalented.
That would explain, actually, why he feels wrong for these films, because he's...
Aggressively bland.
Well, I'm just thinking about the whole... If he thinks that the point of Disney music is to sing down to the audience, then he doesn't get it.
Eesh. Yeah. No, not at all. No, you got to grab him by the heart. You can't just... sing, would you remember when you were a kid? Maybe you are a kid right now. This is a story of a simple bear.
Well, howdy, folks. You look plum tuckered. Like to set a spell?
Actually, we are tired.
And hungry.
Well, we got plenty of room here and all the fresh apples you can eat.
Oh, Peter, we found a new home.
What are you talking about? We're going to Natick.
For what? A Twinkie factory that might not even exist anymore?
She's right. Besides, this place is paradise.
Sure is. Except for Randy Newman.
Randy Newman?
Yep. Just sits there all night and day, singing about what he sees.
Fat man with his kids and dog. Drove in through the morning fog. Hey there, Rover. Come on over.
Well, it's nice to have music while we eat.
Red-headed lady. Reaching for an apple, gonna take a bite. Nope, nope. She gonna breathe on it first. Wipes it on her blouse. She takes a bite, chews it once, twice, three times, four times, stops. Saliva working, takes a long, hard look at Randy. Five times, fat old husband walking over.
Let's get the hell out of here.
And they're walking down the road. Left foot, right foot, left foot, right foot, left.
Side note, by the way, while I have invoked both South Park and Family Guy on this episode, I would like it known that over time, I consider both shows have contributed in no small part to a deeply cynical and nihilistic worldview for more than one generation. A dangerous political ennui in the young, which led to the false equivalency of Clinton and Trump, a pathetic argument which has had a measurable cost of lives in the interim years, the normalizing of rape culture jokes, and just generally encouraging humanity to wallow in selfish complacency rather than make the world better. I wish they hadn't done that.
The absence of the appropriate content as well. I mean, we said this a couple of times. There's no I want in this.
Yes. We said that about Home on the Range as well. There's definitely no I want in that. But in this, Kenai wants to be important to the tribe, clearly. He wants to be a big, tough warrior, and his totem is actually kind of important. He's given the bear of love, which he rejects. He doesn't want love. It's sissy. His elder brother is it the eagle of
the eagle of
guidance, and that's very important. He does end up being a major guide to them. The middle brother, Denahi, says something along the lines of wisdom, but we never see his totem. And it's like, what is this totem? And it felt like it was very important, but then we never see it. And it's like, you couldn't have put 1 minute of that moose chat away and done what Denahi's totem is and actually given him a proper arc. Because to get to wisdom, you need something. And he's robbed of that, really.
Agreed. There's a moose
commentary, by the way, folks. If you get the DVD, you can listen to it commentated upon by two annoying moose.
Oh, boy.
Carry on, sorry.
I think, like, a lot of the puzzle pieces for this film being emotionally super powerful are there. They just somehow they don't connect. Like, the idea of Kenai going out and, in his anger, attacking a bear, killing it, then becoming a bear, and then seeing his brother, who is not the middle brother, who is not shown himself to be a violent, aggressive type before this, become like him, and seeing himself reflected in what his brother's becoming into, and just seeing that shift in roles and that shift in perspective that it creates, and especially tied to all of that, the little bits and scenes in the second half of this movie where Kenai is realizing how bears see humans, like all of those pieces are there for a really powerful emotional arc that I don't think the film quite lands. It's even though it's trying to, it's got the pieces are there, but they're not connected, I don't think.
There's a really great moment when he sees a cave painting of a bear facing down a stick figure with holding a spear, and says something along the lines of, you know, look at these monsters are scary. And Coda says, yeah, especially with when they've got those sticks. And, you know, it's like, actually, if you think about it, we're the monsters, which is a really nice way. That's for the youngsters, but it's a really great way of going, without being too patronizing, because ultimately it's also characterization.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Here's the major problem with it, and we've talked about it before, and this is what it really comes down to. It's the two films being mashed together. On the one hand, you've got man living in relative respectful harmony with animals, and we are part of nature and basically live. This is like, look back when we lived alongside nature and the world was young and we hadn't ravaged it because we weren't doing that yet. This is, you know, showing primitive man to modern man and saying, look, we kind of had it right back then, And in some places in the world, we're still doing that. They're basically living off the land, and it's about as natural and as accurate as I suppose you can really show in a Disney film of man living alongside nature. Then when you show nature, from nature's point of view, it's a bear party.
There's nothing complicated about the way we live. We're all here for each other. Everything we need, the moon, the sun. There is more than enough here for everyone. All we have we share, and all of us we care. So come on, welcome to our family time. Welcome to our brotherly time.
And ducks can talk, and geese can talk, and moose can talk, and they all live in harmony, and they have fun, and they talk like Americans and Canadians, and then you can ride on a mammoth's tusks, and the fish talk, and you can eat the fish that talk. That's in this little bit at the end. And you have a big bear party, and it's just fun. And isn't that just what nature's really... No. They're trying to have their cake and eat it at this point. They're trying to present us with one tone, which is the Pocahontas tone. But remember in Pocahontas when like everything like seems to really kind of work, and then you stick Flit and Miko in there, and suddenly she's got these two annoying animals which don't really fit with the rest of the world, but they're there for the kids. And it's like they've mashed in the everything from the animals' points of view is just for the kids, and everything else is what? Just for the grown-ups or the kids who can pay attention for just long enough until they get to the silly stuff. And so it's this weird kind of... They ram naivety in with more of a spiritual wisdom.
Do you think that's because they think that kids can't cope with nature red in Tooth and Claw?
I mean, you don't actually have to show things eating things. But, I mean, what film has actually shown that?
The Lion King.
Yeah, The Lion King. Yeah, there's carnivores and there's
death, there's destruction. I mean, they're transposing.
There's a gallows humour to it with Timon talking about that they're going to get eaten. And the gazelle are never characterised. But there's
a lot of seriousness to Lion King, though. Even with Timon and Pumbaa in it, there is a lot of seriousness to Lion King when it wants to have that moment. Yeah.
The welcome to our family bit of it is probably the low point of the film for me. Because although it is, you know, fun to see these bears living, they're Care Bears. I think one of the lines is even, we're bears because we care, or something along those lines. Like, seriously? You're giving me the actual Canadian Care Bears? And then you're introduced to two young love bears who are like, I love you. No, I love you. And it's just too much. And it's a shame because the bits from human eyes looking at animals, specifically the wiser, older Inuit, is really refreshingly straight for Disney.
You know, that actually makes me wonder if it's not like this would have like suddenly made the movie incredible or anything, but if when Kenai turns back into a human at the end and he's looking at Coda and Coda's scared and he's caring about Coda, if Coda's eyes were then in black animal form, but you still could see now as a viewer and from his eyes, the recognition of thought and of caring and him still caring about this creature, even though he's not seeing cartoony person.
They didn't take that risk. He's still cartoon Coda. You're absolutely right.
It's would have been a tiny little touch ultimately, but just could have been interesting to try. I think what you're discussing, though, is probably the thing that ultimately makes me have a hard time getting invested in or caring about this movie. It's because it feels like they are trying to have a couple different movies in here, and those different movies they have are both pale imitations of what they've done before.
Yeah.
It's an attempt at a big, epic Lion King-style musical that doesn't resonate anywhere nearly as strong as The Lion King does. It's also an attempt to capture that Pocahontas gravitas, and also big, epic musical doesn't quite reach those heights either. And Pocahontas isn't perfect either, but like it doesn't quite land what Pocahontas does either. So it just feels like a pale imitation done out of desperation at the tail end with a lower budget, less resources, and just no chance left. And it just doesn't stick for me.
I wouldn't go so far as pale myself. I would say slightly misshapen imitation. Like it's hung too many things from the Christmas tree, and now it's lopsided and weird.
Like they're trying to go for everything that they've done before and not quite hitting any of them squarely on the mark.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it.
Like I say, it does have some really nice elements to it, and I'll be watching this one again and again, throughout my life. And I'm pleased that it exists. I'm very sad that it was mismanaged enough to kind of seal the fate of Disney's 2D animation at that stage.
Yeah, it wasn't unprofitable. It actually did make money.
Yeah, it's $250 million.
Yeah, which is fine, but
it made more than it cost.
Like Finding Nemo made that in like 2 months. So like, and it came out the same year. This was not the Hail Mary success that they needed.
It suffers the same sort of problems. You know how the same problem with Bambi. So you got the hunter and and it's like, that's the Red and Tooth and Claw. That's the actual, this is a dangerous world because of man. Man has entered the forest. And then that's immediately followed by let's sing a gay little spring song. And it's like the bunnies in and the whole Twitter painted section is so cloyingly sweet. And ultimately, for bears, just because they're at the top of the food chain doesn't mean that they don't have to struggle to survive. So Kodoka basically has said, look, obviously we still have to eat. So let's, we need to also fight off other, predators who are competing for the same meat. So, and those herbivores we occasionally go after, if we piss off a goat, it could do us some real damage. And that bit where the rams are shouting at the echo is so tedious. It's like that doesn't even work in context.
Yeah, and it's unnecessary because they're clearly only introduced for that gag. There's no point to having that scene in there.
Yeah.
No, you shut up!
Hey, will you shut up? No. Just shut up!
When this film is trying to be just dramatic, it's actually really pretty good. When it's trying to be funny, it is cringe-inducingly unfunny. It works against itself. It undermines its own gravity. This is why script is so important.
Like the goats don't show up again until the end to kind of bring the gag back. Yeah. And then
it wasn't funny the first time.
Exactly. And that reminds me of the sort of meta level end credits, lots of gags playing over the credits. And then the final weird sort of fourth wall breaking
talking fish. No fish were harmed in the making of this picture. Yeah.
It doesn't feel at all right for this movie and what this movie was. It feels more Aladdin-y, or honestly, it feels more Pixar film because that's what Pixar films did that early on. They had end credits where they had sort of the cut
outtakes,
which for Pixar in retrospect, I think they don't do it anymore because I think they found that it feels a little bit weird and goofy and kind of undercuts some of what the film does.
Yeah.
But it's just one more way that this film feels like it's imitating other successes, even in places where it does not feel appropriate for what they are trying to do.
Yeah.
Undercutting themselves.
It's lacking one absolutely standout performance as well. If Michael Clark Duncan had been in it and it had actually been a dramatic performance from him and there had been some real pathos to it, that could have been like Mufasa levels of incredible.
Yeah. I do really wish we could have heard more of him.
Oh. Yeah.
But I mean, like, there's no genie in it. There's no, who's the standout vocal performance in Beauty and the Beast is actually Beast. His,
The great and unsung Robbie Benson.
I asked nicely, but she refuses.
What does she want me to do? Beg? Show me the girl.
Well, the master's really not so bad once you get to know him. Why don't you give him a chance?
I don't want to get to know him. I don't want to have anything to do with him.
I'm just fooling myself. She'll never see me as anything but a monster. It's hopeless.
This incredible power behind that. Lance Henriksen in Tarzan, there's so much that can be said about a presence on screen in a Disney film.
On balance, the most impressive vocal performance in this entire film is actually Jeremy Suarez as Coda. You know, he's a precocious little stinker, but so much of the drama of this film is actually resting on his little shoulders and those of the animators that bring Coda to life. But it's lacking that weight of a Mufasa, of a Judge Claude Frollo, or an Ursula, or a Megara. And, you know, Joaquin Phoenix is absolutely fine in it. But, you know, Matthew Broderick was absolutely fine as Simba.
The most interesting thing that happened to me this year. I know. Listen to this. I'd say it was when I finally knocked down that tree that was blocking the view from my cave. Now I got a family of chipmunks staying in my place.
Yeah. And then, out of the trees, jumps the hunter! And now, there's nowhere for Mom to go. The monster has her backed up against this giant glacier! The monster attacks! Ha! But Mom's too quick for him. And before he can do it again, she stands up real big and yells, "Go away!"
Gina!
Then Mom smells more of them. There's a whole pack coming right at her.
You can know it! The bear!
So she runs out to stop them before they can get to me.
This is one of those films where, like, 55 minutes of it is actually really quite great, and 20 minutes of it is really quite ugh. And had it had half an hour instead of, like, even better than the really quite great, it could have been, like, give it a much more meaningful midsection and a bigger ending which encompasses more than simply, you know, I've learned my lesson, I care about one other brother. It's over so quickly. Like, he's on his journey like about halfway through, and then he learns his lesson way too quickly after they haven't really done much. They got mammoths to take them most of the way, and then they had a party with some bears, and then the middle brother shows up, and there's that, the showdown. It is, however, I realized after watching it, or during watching it, really has been, the elements of this crept into Tiger's Eye, I realized now. That I made Tiger's Eye with a lot of Tarzan in mind, but I hadn't realized quite how much Brother Bear was also in there as well. So
interesting.
I think Tiger's Eye fans might notice some when they watch it next. Are we done on Brother Bear?
I don't think I have anything else really to add about it.
School of Movies is funded by our loyal supporters on Patreon. And our $15 tier get named support credit. So a huge thank you once again to Joel Robinson, Abel Savard, Kevin Otero, Luke Hatfield, Nick Ord, Sarah Montgomery, Duran Barnett, Tom Painter, Finbar Nicole, Jameis Enright, Mark Lush, Dan Mayer, Joe Crow, Chris Finnick, Toby Jungius, Dave Hickman, Aaron Lecluse, David Garcia Abril, Kieran Datchler, and Lorraine Chisholm. And to everyone who supports us on Patreon, you guys keep us going. And if once again we've underestimated Phil Collins, let us know on Twitter if he was the perfect voice for Brother Bear. We want to know, because we like to set the record straight. It's not just about our opinions on this show. Maybe his, and I'm quoting Dan here, aggressively bland music was very appealing to some of you. I don't know, maybe Sting would have been better.
In the quiet time of evening, when the stars assume their petals, and the day has made his journey, and we wonder just what happened to the
Either way, at School of Movies. And especially share this show around, folks. Some more people are coming to us as a direct, measurable result of being promoted on Twitter, who've never heard us before. So if you like the Disney shows, let people know. And you can see Dan's work on YouTube with New Frame Plus. And we will be back next week with a double bill of barnyard shenanigans in two of Disney's grottiest movies, Home on the Range, starring accredited bigot Roseanne Barr, and Chicken Little, as we chart their painful transition from 2D cell animation to 3D computer animation. And entered maybe their darkest hour.
Take a look through my eyes.